were deeply impressed by the range of his knowledge, at least range of issues about which he was well informed. I suppose we need to make a difference on information and knowledge. I know if I mentioned before that Dean Rusk and others who met him, I remember Rusk coming back from the meeting, I had a whole briefing book, but before I get a few minutes into it, he picked it up and basically threw back at me my briefing book. I never met a world leader so well informed on detail. I think you start out there. We all know he read omnivorously on an awful lot, probably on the wrong thing in terms of the latest technology and arms, etc. I think one goes back to the early 50s, and of course the general impression in the U.S. government was of a fairly weak individual, indecisive, very uncertain of himself, a person with a number of personality problems, a man perhaps not of great courage, the way he fled, of course, in the Mossadegh period, and the fact that in a period several months before that, he would have been quite happy to leave the country, but was prevailed upon not to do so. So he had this whole period of looking back, in which all the NSC papers, which I've read since then, indicate a great concern about the caliber of the man. We move through the early period of the Kennedys, in which we were fairly intrusive, frankly, in terms of pushing reform. The Shah seized upon this, but had reform himself, he had this in mind himself. And I think it's always, this is kind of from reading, not from personal contact, obviously in my position, that he himself was starting to look ahead in the sense of the mark that he would make on his country as the Shah and Shah. Obviously, when he got rid of Ali Amini as prime minister in 62, 63, he became less susceptible to American advice. He was getting older. His marriage to Farah and produced offspring fairly soon thereafter. The future, at least of the Pahlavi name, seemed to be assured. He was very happy with Farah, as far as one could see, a very bright, attractive person. And then, of course, we stopped our military assistance in terms of grants, loans, and our economic assistance. There was a period in there in which slowly one could see his, what appeared to be, developing self-confidence, a sense that he no longer really was that susceptible or really didn't want often advice from outside, that he felt that having been in power by the late 60s, you get 20-some years, that he was competent to direct things himself. Like some people say, a little bit of megalomania developed there with, 2,500 years of the of kingship in Iran. But at least I think, and many other people, maybe they were not impressed, but took on this new assertiveness as a natural development of, as a person got older, more self-confident. I think probably when we move on into the late 70s, one could see that many of those original uncertainties reappeared. But again, as a foreign leader, he was a delight to deal with from an ambassador's point of view, or even as a poor country director well down the line. Because if you took an issue to him, he understood it very quickly. He probably was totally briefed anyways. You knew what his world view was. If he made a decision, a decision was made, period. And in those years, I think that's what impressed many of us, is that the ambassador would go in and ask for a particular thing and say, fine. give me the details of what you need later on. And he would not go along with something just for the sake of pleasing the United States. It was a question of any proposal that came to him would immediately slide into his view of worldview, as well as what he thought was good for Iran. Now, there were things that he was willing to help us on that would not appear to have had a direct relationship with Iran's security, such as at one point he was willing to help Somalia with arms, he was willing to help Zaire, he was even willing to help Chad back.
Military assistance.
With some military assistance.
Just on his own initiative, or U.S. Request, or
on our initiative?
Yeah.
And I think an Iranian who, I'll say, was not sympathetic to the Shah would see this as toadying to the United States, when in fact, from his point of view, assisting countries like Chad in its resistance to a Gaddafi, helping Somalia against Mengistu, who was getting with the Soviets with a major base, helping Zaire because of Angola. All of these he saw in the world picture of helping anti-communist struggles, and with a sort of a geographic view of the fact that he used to say, you know, in the event of war, the Soviets, with their massive strength in Ethiopia, which juts out into the Indian Ocean, which could interdict, you know, in theory, Iranian shipping, Western shipping. Then on the reverse side of the African coast, you had Angola. So he saw these in very broad terms. Helping Chad was an anti-Qaddafi action, and he saw Qaddafi as a major threat. As a major threat, as a threat to stability in North Africa. A threat to Sudan, as a threat to Egypt, by which time when we get into this period, the relationships with Egypt were very, very bad, and with Sudan with them. So this is a man with a world view who, as people have written since, I think it's probably true, who probably had as clear an understanding of world trends and events as any leader is likely to have. What is probably unfortunate, in retrospect, of course, that some of this energy wasn't turned inward. I can't, you know, it's very popular to denigrate the Shah these days. I find it very hard to go along with, frankly. He's a man with weaknesses. I don't know any human being that doesn't have them. As a man of great capacities. When I was in Iran to jump ahead, I went three times, I guess, three or four times, to sit with him on different occasions. One was the visit of Dave Newsom, who went out to talk about, in a sense, the threat that is posed by the situation in Afghanistan, the revolution there in May of 78, I guess it was. And General Heiser came out to talk about some military matters, and Lady Bird Johnson came out. And on those occasions, I just found him terribly well informed. I found him not nearly as stiff as his pictures would suggest. And there was a warmth to the individual. I could go on and on, but I think that's enough for your purposes.
Okay.
Thanks for your question.
Okay. Might have some more later on. Now, one issue you mentioned last time when you were talking about your duties as director, as country director during the 70s, was the whole question of human rights. You said you had a lot of correspondence that you had to supervise from people who were complaining about, who had questions about Iran's human rights policies. What were your views, or what was your understanding on the extent of the problem with human rights in Iran during this period?
Well, it's perfectly clear that really open political activity was not permitted. It's perfectly clear that the people, Savak and the police, took a very liberal interpretation of the things that one should not be allowed to do, which is to promote communism, talk against the monarchy, and the Constitution. There are three things in there that were not permitted.
Uh-huh.
And clearly, the authorities interpreted this broadly, so that there definitely was a not a free society, whether it came to individual speech or whether it came to the press or the media. I think I was impressed by the fact, however, that there was a development, I mean, through the 70s, until I was disappointed at the time when the Shah broke up the political parties and brought in the one-party Rastakis. I thought there was a healthy political process going on with Iran Novin, Haveda, very active as a politician. And I've always been very, I believe that democratic processes or less oppressive policies develop slowly. Iran does not have a democratic tradition. And so I thought the processes were going on about as rapidly as they could. And here you are, the chicken and the egg kind of thing. But, you know, starting around 74, they did have a terrorist problem. Did the terrorist problem develop because of the lack of, democracy, free speech, and all this sort of thing? And therefore, of course, say it was a result of the oppression. I don't know, but since Americans had been killed, Americans were being targeted very, very persistently in the mid-70s, I think one tended, at least I tended, to view the Shah's efforts to maintain a fairly tight control with some sympathy. But again, as we've discussed before, my overriding concern was the larger issues of the relationship. I did not want to see any single issue advocates have a major impact on the total relationship. And that's what concerned me at times about the human rights, who are only looking at one small part of a large pie, and really would have liked to have policy determined on that one issue. And that's what upset me as much as anything with the human rights effort. And also having a little understanding, not much at the time, of Iran's past history, in which, you know, the foreign intrusion has been, was at times excessive, but this would appear to them to be another effort for outsiders to tell them what to do, just sort of the wrong thing at that particular time, since, as I said before, by the time the human rights people got heavily engaged in Iran, Iran had gone beyond, well beyond the point of accepting happily American initiatives and American ideas on such on this subject. I was also concerned that, and here admitting my own rather abysmal lack of understanding of, at times, of the Iranian society as a whole, I was always worried that we were sending the wrong signal to people, to the Shah, the government, or others, with a lot of this human rights activity. I was also distressed by the fact that we always got terribly excited about human rights in countries where we had an alliance relationship. And as an aside, I had written a couple of pages for a book that Georgetown University put out under Dave Newsom on human rights and foreign policy. And I was rather cryptic. I said, I guess the message was that if you can't beat up on your enemies, beat up on your friends. If you recall, going back in those days, it was Korea, the Philippines, and Iran that was under continuous scrutiny by Congress and others. And of course, three countries, at least in a geopolitical sense, which could not be of any, of the greatest importance to us. I suppose now, in retrospect, can be argued, had we been more active in working with the Iranians, et cetera, some of the, you know, maybe the revolutionary steam could have been let off. You know, I don't buy that. But so my main concern, I say, was that that this not become something that screwed up the relationship as a whole.
Do members of Congress bring their concerns about these questions to your, to your attention directly, or?
I don't know how many letters we wrote back to individual congressmen, various human rights groups. I testified before Don Fraser and his subcommittee once. So, we weren't active and terribly active in terms of doing much about human rights, but that's another story. We were terribly active in simply answering correspondence and congressional interest. I think later on human rights, I'm just trying to think about that.
Now, by 1975, William J. Butler, who was working with the International Organization of Jurists, I forget the exact name.
The International Commission of Jurists.
Commission of Jurists, okay. He was centering his attention on human rights problems in Iran. Did you meet with him from time to time?
I met with Bill Butler several times. And to be perfectly frank, he was the first person in this human rights crowd that I had much time for, because he had a very mature understanding of what he was talking about. He did not expect massive social change in a year, 2 years kind of thing. An eminently sensible person. And his objective, which I fully supported, and which later Ambassador Sullivan fully supported, was to talk with the Shah and other Iranians about a better way to handle due process. He felt, and got the Shah eventually to agree to changes in the military tribunal system. I don't know whether those changes ever really got in place because of the maelstrom that came. But here was an approach by Bill, and I think his French colleague, Juris, was with him on the first trip, of looking at a legal system and suggested doable changes which would be of great benefit to individuals. They did not mean a revolution in Iran's handling, Iran's concern about dissidents, but would provide the dissidents with a proper due process, so if somebody just wasn't willy-nilly coming up in a closed system, went off to jail, something that he hadn't done. And so he came up with a variety of suggestions with respect to changing the law, kind of outside defense lawyers, for one. As I recall, the one was ability to present witnesses. Don't hold me to but he discussed all of these memoranda that he gave the Shah with me before he went out. He checked in with the ambassador to show the ambassador what he was going to do, not asking for my approval or the ambassador's approval. He was an independent person. But he wanted to make sure that we were informed as the people most responsible in government for Iranian affairs, and to receive advice. But had the advisement, don't do it, and he felt that it was proper that he would have gone ahead and done it. He's a very independent person, very intelligent. I have great admiration for that kind of approach. It's a very doable thing. It's not in the public eye kind of thing. Something quietly comes along and changes the process.
Okay. Now, did the human rights controversy that was going on inside the U.S. during the 4 years, 75, 76, have much of an impact on the diplomatic relationship with Iran?
Actually, I think I just simply don't recall this issue being on front burner during the whole Nixon Ford issue. But it doesn't mean to say I wasn't getting my letters. By the scores, a meeting with human rights advocates who'd come down from New York and be interested in this particular poet or this writer, etc. After such meetings, I would probably, or not probably, usually, either write a letter or send a telegram to Tehran just keeping Tehran informed. Yeah, asking for information, too, on who, what is the status of this boy? Is he really in jail, as these people say? So we had a dialogue back and forth with the embassy on that sort of thing. And on occasion, appropriate occasion, somebody in the embassy, Jack Nichols, probably not usually the ambassador, I kept this thing down one level.
I think Archie Bolster worked on the stuff in the embassy to some extent.
But you might mention it to the deputy minister of court that it wouldn't hurt if so-and-so were released or so-and-so allowed to receive a passport so he could come to the United States. And sometimes this worked and sometimes it didn't work. The whole, as you all know, the whole human rights thing didn't really become a major issue until, in terms of government, handling until the Carter period and Pat Darien came and gone.
Now, in his new book, James Bell mentions that around mid-76, the Shah allowed strong criticisms of the U.S. to appear in the Iranian press. I guess some of the articles criticized the U.S.'s reliability as an ally, among other things. Did you know much about these critical articles, or do you remember much about this?
I don't remember specifically. Yeah. Yes, I mean, I remember that particular period because the embassy was assiduous in sending unclassified, often the same as the following article appeared in Kahan and all this and that. So, yeah. And to me, my reaction was two. As one, that there simply is something directed above, from above, as a needle to us. And the other one was that on some of the criticism was absolutely valid. And I think we, as we've seen now, there is space in Central America and around the world, Vietnam, maybe we haven't been as reliable. We have our own reasons, but if you're a foreigner looking at it, it adds up to making you very nervous. I was with a friend who was part of the East Berlin to CIA, which had out in the Beltway, coming from doing some work, and I found that this very issue was the fact that we often deal with a country sort of day by day, week by week. We don't pay that much attention to it. It's when a crisis occurs, and we get heavily engaged, and then we're out of it. Whereas most countries in the world, and this is probably less true today, but certainly is true in the 70s, and in parts of the world very much true today, are continuously looking at us. And we're not continuously looking at them in terms of their reliability, but whatever we do or don't do can have such a massive impact on a particular country. They always have a microscope looking at us. And a lot of other people tend to relate. In other words, if, let's say this condition was still going on in Iran as before the revolution, they had the Iran-Contra. Not the Iran, but just the aid to the Contras, and off and on again, the aid. The Shah and people around him have been totally perplexed of why we weren't much more resolute in defending what he would see to be is very much in our interest. And so therefore he would be starting to wonder, what does this mean? And I think if you saw Jane Kilpatrick's article in the Post over the weekend, sort of lessons that should have been learned from the Noriega episode, I don't particularly like her writing, I don't like her approach to many things as foreign affairs. And she's very badly informed of the Middle East. She made one very good point, though, is that Noriega and others and they have to be encouraged by the fact of the mess that we have handled in terms of the Contras. Now, it doesn't matter how you look at the Contra aid, how I look at the Contra aid, we're looking at it from our own political perspective. But they're looking at it and drawing quite different lessons by the intent. That's a little speech I had to get out of my mind.
That's interesting. What to think about. Now, after Jimmy Carter became president in early 77, the U.S. had no ambassador in Iran. Between December 76, when Richard Pellet resigned and left the country, I guess in June 77, when Sullivan arrived in Iran as ambassador. What accounted for the long gap between Helms and Sullivan? Because usually the gaps aren't quite that long, I don't think. I've looked at some of the, maybe a few months sometimes, not, maybe not, but usually not 5 or 6 months.
It's funny, I really don't know. I think, I think a great deal of it was the fact of a new administration pulling together its, and getting advice from the State Department and others of who should be ambassador in different places. The Carter administration understood that Iran was a unique and difficult and very important assignment. I have no idea how many people they looked at before they, and would hear rumors, and I've forgotten the name, that so-and-so was under consideration. But though, for reasons that he, if you read his book, he was selected. But it's interesting, I didn't worry that much about it, because I didn't think the administration was that slow. It was a little slow, and it should have been. But it worried the hell out of the Iranians. They simply could not understand why a country, the way they viewed this, of its significance, was not so immediately filled by a top-notch man. I'm not sure whether Carter, I read Carter's book, I don't think it's addressed, I'm not sure it's addressed in Vance's book either, or Brzezinski's, of why the delay and why the selection of Bill. I think with Bill, he was known as a, theoretically, as a fairly tough customer. You know, I suppose the assessment initially came down, he's a top-notch career man. He's tough, he's not hoodwinked easily. And he's just the perfect type to deal with the Iranians at that time. But the delay, I guess, essentially bureaucratic rather than political or policy, but it did worry the Iranians tremendously at the time.
But otherwise, it didn't make much difference to your work at the country desk?
No. It made a difference in terms of, I kept always getting hints from Iranians at the embassy here, and keep getting hints of little bit things out of Tehran, maybe official informal. You know, again, the Iranians asking, why isn't there an ambassador appointed? And they did view this as a slight. It worried them that it meant there was going to be a major change in policy, and that this was sort of the lead up to a major change in U.S. policy.
Okay. Now, how would you appraise Sullivan as ambassador? How effective was he as ambassador, given the fact that he had to deal with extraordinary circumstances? You try to discount that. How would it turn out otherwise?
I would think he was a first-rate ambassador. I think he developed a kind of rapport with the Shah, with others that an American ambassador simply had to have. I think he always spoke frankly and openly to the Shah. There was no grumbling and acting like an Iranian courtier. He was a very straightforward person. I think he was very, very perceptive of the people he was dealing with. In terms of running the embassy, he was in between Dick Helms and some ambassadors that I've worked with. He probably got into a little more detail, I want to be more informed in detail than Helms would have. But when I went there in May of 78 and went into his office, I said, okay, Bill, what's my role? How do you see it? That's the way you see it, it's the way it will be. And he said, look, I'm the head political officer here. He said, I want your views. Nothing will go out of this embassy if you're in town that you won't see. Nothing will come in that you won't know about. But I don't want you to worry. I spent a lot of time fretting about the politics. I want you to run this place. I want you to sign off and send out the message where I can on economic, administrative matters, et cetera, work with the consulates, coordinate, all that. Those are your problems. I'll handle the political. I said, fine. And I'd say, most of the time, I did. I just ran the place, for good or for bad. But he did say, probably more than Helmsley, he wanted to know at the end of each week, or maybe at the end of a couple of working days, what I had been doing. It's pretty good management technique. So it got me, I kept notes as the day went on, of decisions I had made. Every now and then he'd reverse one. And let most times they found out he was one being formed. So in that sense, I think he's quite good. He, as you know from this picture, a very striking looking man. And I think the people that he dealt with have considerable respect for him. And you know, this leads on in, obviously, to the main course, shall we say, is how perceptive was he and was I or others in terms of the nature of the gathering storm. An awful lot's been written about that, and we really go into it to the extent that you want to.
Well, maybe later on, but yeah. Not. It would come up.
One thing I did come up before is that Bill, too, was rather appalled at our ignorance of Iran, and he did open the doors, frankly, to a political, for us to start seeing other people.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Strangely, this is an aside, of course, is that, again, we took that action for good and sufficient reasons. The Iranians did not see it that way. There's different perceptions. So I'm afraid that many Iranians saw the current human rights policy and the greater effort by the U.S. government to know people who were not part of the establishment as a signal that we were weakening in our support of the Shah, and that was absolutely not the purpose, but the Iranians did read it that way. And that's one of the real problems. If you have an embassy, a period of time which you've been fairly restrictive in your contacts, and you get back to what should be the normal process of an embassy, it then raises a lot of questions. What are you doing? So you really put yourself in a terrible hole. Any ambassador who tries to restrict contacts and reporting, it's all right for his period in town. But the next guy that comes along, the situation may change a little bit. He's just a different person. You've complicated his life immeasurably.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Through the Carter period, you mentioned Sullivan a little bit, but who were some of the other officials and the other agencies who worked on Iran during 77 and 78 that you would have worked with? People at Defense, for example, or Commerce, or other departments?
Most of my work, really, was within the department. At the beginning, one, of course, on the human rights side, you had Patricia Darien.
Mm-hmm.
At the White House and the NSC staff, you had Margaret Tuckman's daughter, I forget what her name was, who was very interested in the control of regular arms sales.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I never dealt much with her directly, but I dealt with her in meetings and in political military affairs, and the former New York Times correspondent Leslie Gelb, who got very much engaged in those early years and talks with the Russians about cutting down the flow of conventional arms to third world nations.
Mm-hmm.
These would be later on, of course, Gary Sick in the NSC as more or less the Iran man. Those would be the principal ones.
Mm-hmm.
At that period, sort of in the level, since above me, that's who were in charge. Frankly, many years were my one-on-one issue people. At the Pentagon, I dealt most frequently with General Fish.
He's still there under Carter.
For a while, I had to get the time of change of that. And I forget who his successor was, but that would have been my principal line of contact over there. You know, when we finally got to the decision-making time. And there's several other people on his staff, his names sort of gone by. At the agency, again, I would have been a little bit more the old boy network of people that I knew over there talking on a couple of issues that were very formal groups established back in the Carter period, I mean the Ford period, that continued on into the Carter period. At Commerce, once the Kissinger left, the Joint Commission was not as big a thing, although in the Carter period, we did have one major meeting, one that I can remember, here in Washington, which I'm sorry, Bed, and Secretary Vance, in fact, was the chairman of the U.S. side. But, let's see, Carter came in, what, 77, I left. I mean, Carter came in, sorry, January 77. I left in the summer of 78, so I only had about 15 months in Washington with the Carter period.
That's right, yeah.
And I think the biggest issue at the time, of course, was the limits that Carter wanted to set, yearly limits, with reductions each year on the sale of conventional arms. That took an enormous amount of time, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
Just the papers that flowed.
Mm-hmm.
So finally there was a various decisions taken on that.
Okay. A little bit ago, you mentioned something I was going to follow up earlier, but I didn't. The question of the Shah support getting military assistance of some sort to Somalia, Chad, and Zaire. Was this under the Ford administration or under Carter, or both administrations for that matter?
Certainly aid to Somalia, to the best of my recollection, had come up during the previous administration, but took a bizarre twist, frankly, during the Carter administration. As you know, under the law, you cannot permit a country to ship U.S. material unless you yourself would ship that material or equivalent material to country X, say. And Somalia was not on the list of countries that could receive arms. There was a brief window in there in which I guess we were thinking of making Somalia eligible. So the proposal was put to the Iranians, would you help Somalia? And yeah, sure. You know, what do they need? And I don't know if it's literally true. I was told that it was literally true. Is that so? They felt they had an understanding with us, and so they loaded up a couple of airplanes with small arms and various things. The policy changed when we decided not to make Somalia eligible for arms. So Franklin Tisgram went out to the ambassador. I was on the desk at the time. I mean, I said, hurry up and go see the Iranian and tell them they can't ship the arms. Well, they claimed that the airplanes were literally, you know, on the apron ready to take off. They were loaded. And so, poor ambassador had to go through this embarrassing thing to say that, you know, over in the course of about 10 days or something like that, policy said yes, no, yes, no.
This is under Helms.
No, this is the under
Sullivan. Okay.
And we had to, so the Iranians said they took off all American supplied stuff that was on there, and sent a couple of plane loads of their own equipment they received from elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
It was embarrassing, I guess. On the Chad thing, we were looking around wherever we could for some help, because we were in a position not being able to help Chad very much at the time, of giving arms, having the Shah provide some help and arms to Chad.
This is again under the Ford period?
Hmm? No, this was on in Carter period.
Okay.
And again, he was willing to do so. He was learning fast if we did so. And we went through a terrible, I don't know all the details, but All I know is I got so tired of reading about Habre and all those people in Chad, because the department has once you get on a particular set of messages, it seems to me you stay there forever. So Chad felt they had to keep us totally informed. But that's an area, again, sounds to decline. Now, I don't know the details of how much they helped Zaire, but there was help.
Uh-huh.
Went there and at our request.
Okay. Now, one aspect of part of this public diplomacy was what you mentioned earlier, the question of human rights, the emphasis on human rights. It was strongly made in his inaugural address and other public statements. Now, from your vantage point to the country desk during 77 and part of 78, how much of a difference did this emphasis have on the way that Carter and Vance actually conducted diplomacy with Iran? Was it really a practical, what kind of practical implications did it have?
When you finally got to the last sentence, it had no immediate impact on decisions. The policy, however, and the Iranian perceptions of that policy and the fears of that policy, the unknowns of that policy, had a considerable impact. It had an impact for a period of time. For example, once the trouble started in early, major trouble started in early 78.
Okay, that's okay.